And while all of us lead imperfect lives, wholeness is not about perfection. Wholeness is about embracing your brokenness as well as what seems unbroken in you. That's what it means to be whole. It's not about being perfect. It's about putting your whole self into the human equation and growing as a result.
In this interview, I'm joined by Dr. Parker Palmer. Parker is an American writer, educator, and activist who focuses on issues in education, community, leadership, spirituality, and social change. He's the founder of the nonprofit, the Center for Courage and Renewal, and author of 10 popular books, including A Hidden Wholeness, The Courage to Teach, An Undivided Life, and Let Your Life Speak, which this interview focuses on. Expect to learn the primary cause of burnout in modern society, the extent to which each of us arrive here with a nature and the importance of living in harmony with it, how to navigate the delicate balance between solitude and community life, Parker's thoughts on the purpose of human existence, and more. This was a hugely impactful conversation for me, and I think Parker might be one of the wisest individuals I've come into contact with. I hope you enjoy. Okay, Parker, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
To get started, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was about, I think you went to a talk from Dorothy Day in your younger years, and she made a comment about the ungrateful poor that had a big impact on you at the time. So I wanted to ask how this influenced your views on giving, on service, and also on the phenomenon of burnout that is very common in our culture today?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. It takes me back to the to the middle of the last century when I was in New York City, living there for a while, and a woman called Dorothy Day, I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with her, but she was a kind of radical left Catholic lay woman who devoted her life to service to the poor. And it wasn't Lady Bountiful kind of service. Instead, she lived with the poor, ate meals with the poor, established an organization and a series of houses called Catholic Worker Houses, where folks like Dorothy and her followers lived right alongside the poorest of the poor in New York City. So I went to Mary House on the Lower East Side of Manhattan one evening, and Dorothy Day herself was speaking that night. They had a series of Friday evening lectures. And on this particular evening, I was sitting at her feet, as it were, enthralled by this great, truly saintly woman. When I heard her make mention somehow of the ungrateful poor, the ungrateful poor, and it was shocking. I thought, why is this woman who devotes her life to service to the poor speaking that way? And then I got it. It was sort of like a Zen koan breaking through. What she was basically saying was, if you're coming down here to serve the poor in expectation and hopes of getting their thanks, you should just go home right now, because they don't owe you any thanks. We owe them a debt of service. They are our brothers and sisters. And the only reason to be here is because you want to express the fullness of your membership in the human community by sharing what you have with those who have none. And that left a lasting mark on me, because I was, I think, in my late 20s at the time. And I realized how some of my social change aspirations, some of the causes that I wanted to devote myself to, were really about me becoming a good guy, me becoming a hero, me being the knight in shining armor who rides in on the white horse to rescue those who have less. And that I understood at some very deep level from Dorothy Day that this was an unsustainable reason to do work of the sort, social change work, to which I felt myself drawn. And I think that, you know, connects profoundly with the question of burnout that you mentioned, Niall, because I think burnout often comes from not from giving too much, but from giving what we really don't have to give or don't have good reason to give in the circumstances of our lives. There's a million needs out there in the human community, and I am not gifted or called to meet all of them. My life intersects the needs of the world at certain particular points, and it's an important act of discernment to figure out what resource grows within me in a renewable way that I can keep giving and giving and giving because it's in my nature to do so. If you're giving of a renewable resource within yourself, burnout is much less likely to happen. And I think Dorothy Day gave me a clue about all of that in this kind of enigmatic Zen koan comment that about the ungrateful poor.
I think there's so much in that story and just a huge lesson. Whenever I first heard it, I was like, it just a light bulb went off my mind. So thank you for sharing that. The quote I love from the book as well, I think it's from a theologian, Frederick Buchner. Your vocation is found where your deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger, something along those lines. So you've got to sort of satisfy both of those criteria. So to what extent, Parker, do you believe that each of us come here with a nature? And is living well about kind of getting to know what that nature is and living in harmony with it rather than trying to be something that we're not?
Well, that's a big, big question, isn't it? And we could talk about that for a long while, but I'm glad you raised it because it's right at the core of my book, Let Your Life Speak. One that I've been walking around and reflecting on for a long time. So if you've spent much time around little kids, infants when they enter the world, young children before the society gets their hands on them and starts conditioning them this way and that, I at least have always seen, observed, and understood that a child doesn't come into this world as a blob of malleable plastic to be shaped any way the world wants to shape it. In fact, I think it's a very pernicious view of human beings that we are somehow malleable material that can be shaped into whatever the economy or the political system or the social arrangements of our lives need us to be. So a child, I think, comes into the world as this kind of person rather than that or that or that. And I've had the privilege in my life as a parent and a grandparent to track the lives of several young kids and see time and again that even in those very early years, human beings have what I call tropisms, like plants. They're attracted towards some things as a plant is attracted to the sun, but they shut down under other circumstances or turn away because that doesn't work for them. And I think it's a deeply driven instinct. One of my favorite things to recommend to young parents or to grandparents is start keeping a record of who this newborn person or recently born person has been from the moment they first showed up on Earth. Try to track the natural gifts that they're expressing in one way or another. Are they drawn toward music? Are they turned off by music or just indifferent to music? Are they drawn toward play or do they like lots of solitary time, just staring out the window or building with blocks? I mean, these are all clues, I think, to the nature that we arrive here with. And it's very important to notice, and any engineer would agree with this, that if we have a nature, we also have limits as well as potentials. When an engineer goes to build a bridge, they inquire into the nature of the material with which they're building to make sure that it can, that becoming a bridge is not going to stress it at its most vulnerable points. And so in the case of a human being, that means that at least the myth in my country, in America, the myth that anybody can be anything they want is simply not true. I just don't have the gifts to do a lot of things I might want to do. On the other hand, I have potentials that I don't want to run away from, but would like to be able to live into or experiment with over the course of the years. So what happens to our original nature as time goes by is that it gets impacted by all of the external conditions that we're all familiar with. Family expectations, norms and standards that get imposed on us when we go to school, the pressures of adult life, whether that comes from trying to maintain relationships with people who are important to us or serving in a job, performing a work that has norms around it. All of these norms and expectations trying to make us into what the world or other people want us to be. And these things do, in fact, impact our lives. It's not that this nature that I come into the world with stands invulnerable against all those pressures. But if I'm aware of what's happening to me, and I think talking about it helps people become aware. If I'm aware of what's happening to me, I can start being more choiceful. I can make better choices about how I deal with some of these external pressures. How far am I willing to go, for example, in stressing the limits of my nature in order to make sure that I can keep earning a salary at this particular job? Ultimately, you know, the question that's been considered in great drama down through the ages is, am I willing to go so far as to sell my soul to the devil in order to be successful or powerful or rich? Dramatists and novelists have worked with that question for a very long time. But for most of us, it falls a little short of dealing with the devil. We're rather kind of dealing with ourselves and asking ourselves questions like, why do I, I'm 35, I'm 40 years old, why has this work I've chosen to do, or maybe someone else chose it for me, why is this feeling so hollow and so empty? Where did I take a wrong turn in the road that has me now living at some distance from the gifts with which I was born, the nature with which I came into this world? That seems to be a midlife or even earlier question for lots and lots of people. And it's not an easy question to answer, but I think it's always a question worth asking and always worth, trying to reach the best approximation that you possibly can of how your true nature can fit into the needs of the world or respond to the needs of the world without getting damaged or stretched out of shape.
Part of me loves this philosophy of, letting your life speak and sort of understanding what your nature is and working with it. And my experience has been to date that anytime I violate that and anytime I go off course from that, life seems to have a mechanism for correcting that. And it's not pleasant, but that seems to be what happens, at least in my own case. But then there's another part of me that it's a quieter part. And I know it's a lot more, it's maybe more of an immature part, but it would then sort of worry that if I just stay within this, my nature, and it's afraid that I will get complacent, I'll stay in my comfort zone and I won't get out of my comfort zone and stretch myself beyond my current capabilities. So how would you respond to that fear?
Well, I don't think that's immature at all, Niall. I think that's a wise question that we all ought to be asking ourselves, because we are organic beings, and organic, whether you think of it in a physical sense or a spiritual sense, I happen to think of it in both senses. Organic means growing, and growing means transformation and change. And I'm very much with you on the desire to express my true nature in a variety of circumstances, to actively engage with the world, with other people, in ways that help me discover more about what the potential expressions of my giftedness are. Because certainly early in life, I have no idea what that range of potential expressions might be. I don't know enough about the world. I don't know enough about myself. But as time goes on, we have an opportunity to test ourselves. And I think sometimes, I make a parallel in my mind sometimes between the way our birthright nature interacts with the world around us and the way geneticists have discovered that the genetic material interacts with various situations. There was a time when geneticists thought that genetic material was stable throughout our lives, and that it never altered. It was just the kind of the fundamental given. But now they've discovered that genetic material expresses itself differently under different conditions. And I think it's exactly that way with what I call selfhood, which is maybe the spiritual equivalent of genetic material, that those birthright gifts that we come with. So for me, a master metaphor that I think speaks to the question you're raising, Niall, is the title that Gandhi gave to his autobiography. He called his life story, "My Experiments with Truth." My Experiments with Truth. And I really love that, those words. I love that image. And the first time I read it, before I even got into his life story itself, I realized, oh, that's what I've been doing for the last 35 years. I've been experimenting with my own truth, with how it is that my selfhood might manifest itself differently under different circumstances, still honoring, still reaching for my potentials, honoring my limitations, but always testing whether I've got that right, because it's not easy to discern with with a high degree of confidence what your potentials or your limitations may be. But if you adopt an experimental model, I will try this and I will see where it takes me, and I will count that as learning on the road of life about where it is I might go next, what it is I might do next. And as you said earlier, sometimes that experiment will take you into a very dark place. I've written about my own descent into depression, adult depression, several times, very serious depression. And I'm quite certain that that had to do with, you know, feeling lost and abandoned as I tried things that weren't working out. But because I've held this experimental model of life and have tried to track what I've been learning from it over the years, I think eventually I got enough information about myself and the world to come closer more often to finding those sweet spots, you know, where as Fred Buechner says, my deep gladness meets the world's deep need. My, let me put it a little differently, my identity and integrity find legitimate expression in some intersection with the world and its needs. It takes time. When I talk with young people, younger people, and at age 85, almost everyone is younger people these days, about this, I'd like to name the fact that I didn't come into a very deep sense of vocation, of my own vocation, until I was 50 years old. It took a lot of experimentation to get there. So, you know, if a person is 25 or 30 and they're worried about not having found their path yet, I'm always glad to say, you got a lot of time, not to worry. Just keep the experiment going. So I can talk, in more detail about some of the experiments I conducted. But for the moment, let me just say that the experimental model, I think, is a very appropriate one for the discovery of vocation. And as every scientist knows, a failed experiment can easily teach you as much, maybe more, than a successful experiment.
Big time. Now, while we're speaking of experiments, I heard you in another interview talk about you write books or you write about subjects that you don't know the answers to, which totally, you know, that really blew my mind, because like you're not going into this as the expert. You're going into here as the person that wants to find something out, and you're going in sort of with an exploratory mindset. And I think that's such a great reframe. And if people could adopt that, it would really free them to try things out more and not have to feel like an expert before they begin. But another experiment that you took on, which I thought was amazing, was this practice of keeping a journal of small things. Can you maybe tell us about that practice and the impact this has had on your life?
Yeah, very much so. And let me just say quickly, since we may not return to the topic, that I can't imagine writing a book about a subject that I've thoroughly mastered. Writing a book is really hard work for me. I've written 10 of them, and you know, each of them has taken many years to write. And to put in all that hard work around a subject that I already understand, that I've already figured out, I can't imagine it. But if the writing itself is a kind of archaeology where you're digging down into the subject to figure out more and more about where is this coming from and how does it work, then the hard work justifies itself, because the learning adventure, you know, is still there. So would you reframe the question that you ended with there?
It was just around your practice of keeping a journal of small things and the impact this has had on your life.
Right. Thank you. So this loops me back to my experiences with clinical depression, which were primarily in my 40s, at a time of life when I was, you know, still very uncertain about how the experiment was working, and struggling with a lot of different dimensions of it. And so in the middle of my first deep depression, which went on for months and months, during which I was really incapacitated, could barely get out of bed, couldn't really stand to be with other people. As I came to say about it eventually, the world was full of knives, or so it felt, and I couldn't even walk out my front door for fear I might run into a neighbor and have to have a conversation. And I was just too deep under the waves, you know, to be able to do that. I could barely breathe. And so I got into therapy for the first time in my life. I was raised in a white, male, upper middle class culture where you just don't go into therapy. If you do, that means you've failed in life. But fortunately, I ended up in a circumstance where I didn't have a choice. And I'm very glad that I broke through that taboo, because I learned that the right therapist can be really, really helpful. So I was talking with this therapist at one of our meetings about my sense of stuckness, how this was never going to change, and the despair that brought, and even the suicidal ideation that it carried with it. Because if you're stuck, and where you're stuck is a deeply dark and miserable place, why would one want to carry on? And he said, after listening to me for a long time and asking me some good questions, he says, I want to suggest that you keep a journal and see what it might teach you. And I interrupted quickly, but I think before he was able to finish his sentence. And I said, well, look, man, you know that I'm a writer. It's how I've made my living. And I can't write right now. I don't have the concentration or really the morale in me to write anymore. And he said, well, let me say a bit more about what I have in mind. I don't mean a journal where you fill pages with the experience you're now having. I mean a journal of small accomplishments. And I said, well, I'm not accomplishing anything. And he said, well, I'm challenging you to find out if maybe you really are, but you don't recognize it yet. And I said, okay, what are we talking about? And he said, well, you told me that you were finally able to get out of bed at 11 o'clock this morning. And tomorrow morning, start a journal page where you put on today's date and you say, got out of bed at 11 a.m. You also told me that while you can't walk out your door for fear of running into a neighbor, you're able to ride your bike, speeding through your neighborhood so that no conversations are possible. And you said that this morning you were able to do that for 10 minutes. So write that down. Got out of bed at 11, rode my bike for 10 minutes. Tomorrow, if you get out of, mark down when you get out of bed. And he said, at some point, you're going to find that you got out of bed a little earlier than 11 o'clock, maybe 10:45. And that's a small accomplishment. And at some point, you're going to find that you rode your bike for 15 minutes, not 10 minutes. And that's a small accomplishment. And he said, I want you to just keep doing that around all these little things that we normally just ignore in our lives. How many meals did you eat today? What kind of food did you eat? How did you pass the time? Just brief notes. And he said, I think what you are going to see is what happens with most depressions, which is that there is a slow upward sawtooth pattern to them. It goes up and down day by day. But what you don't notice if you don't keep a journal of small achievements is that the saw blade is generally trending up. You are returning to health. He said many, many depressions will in fact resolve themselves after a number of months if people can hang in with them and just do the suffering. And as you're trying to do, understand where it's coming from and how to be alert to the signs the next time around and maybe make some mid-course corrections. So in any event, I started keeping that journal of small accomplishments, and it has had a tremendous impact on my life, Niall, because until that point, I was a guy for whom accomplishment meant the next big thing, right? So you wrote three pretty good books. You haven't written one for a few years. What's wrong with you? Why is this one taking so long? Or et cetera, et cetera. You just wrote another book. Or how are the reviews? Because if you're getting any critical reviews, you're a failure, and you need to write another book that won't get any critical reviews. It was always stuff like that, and it was killing me, to hang out in life, which for all of us consists of a million small things that matter. How you treat the clerk at the store is as important as whether your book got well reviewed. The impact we have on other people is vital and says a lot about who we are. And so I learned, to value the little things in life. And I'm so grateful for that at age 85, because at 85, this thing called human limitations does tend to set in. And, I used to be great at multitasking, or I thought I was. I was like a juggler. I could do five things simultaneously. And I just can't do that anymore. It's one thing or at a time, or it's just or it's just sitting and staring out the window. Multitasking is just beyond my reach. The flying around the country that I did for 40 years as an independent writer, teacher, and activist, that's no longer possible for me. Lots of things fall away as you age. And so if I didn't know at this stage of life how to value the small things in life, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
I think this is so powerful. And it seems to me what's happening is people that are very ambitious, a lot of the time they're deriving their self-worth from these big accomplishments that are projected into the future. Whereas whenever you develop a practice like this here, you're essentially flipping that around to developing your sense of self-worth from these small everyday things that you have direct control over. And still moving towards these big goals, but feeling good about yourself as you're moving towards them, you know, which is just so empowering. And
well said. Absolutely. It's all about living in the now, isn't it? As a lot of spiritual teachers counsel us to do.
Sure. Now, can you tell me what you mean by, I know this isn't your phrase originally, but can you tell me by what you mean by the phrase getting fierce with reality?
Yeah, that phrase, I think came from, what is her name? Scott Maxwell is her last name.
Florida Scott Maxwell, is it?
Florida Scott Maxwell. Thank you. Yeah. And a passage in a book that she wrote about aging. I think she wrote it when she was in her 90s. Quite a remarkable book. And roughly speaking, I think the passage says something like, you know, all you need to do is embrace all you have been and done, and you will find yourself fierce with reality. If you have it right there, maybe you could read it. I don't know if you do or not.
I don't have it in front of me, no.
That's okay. I think I roughly got it right just now. So it's all about embracing the truth about yourself and becoming fierce with reality. And I'm very drawn to the phrase because one of the things that was most helpful to me in coming out of depression was realizing, again, with therapeutic help, how many illusions I had been living with. Illusions about myself, illusions about the world, illusions that are generated by ego, by intellect, sometimes by our own sense of misplaced sense of ethics, sometimes even by our spirituality, especially if our spirituality is one that wants to lift us above the travails of life. And I realized that if you live at elevation in your ego or your intellect or your ethics or your spirituality, and you trip and fall, which we do every day, regularly, you have a really long way to fall, and you might kill yourself if you're living at elevation. And I think ego and intellect and ethics and spirituality often create a false sense of elevation. It's not to say those are worthless. It's to say they need to be managed and kept under control in service of real life. If you live on the ground floor of your own truth, the ground floor of the truth about the world around you and how you interact with it, you're going to still trip and fall, but now you don't have far to fall because you're on the ground and you can simply stand up, dust yourself off, and take the next step. And it does turn out, I think, in the long run, that life is a lot about falling down and getting up again and falling down and getting up again. And to live your life on the ground, fierce with reality, that is, having fully as possible engaged the truth of who you are, which includes your limitations as well as your potentials. It includes your failures as well as your successes. It includes your dark nights of the soul as well as your illuminations. To live on the ground is the best possible place to live, precisely because you can get up again and carry on. And you're going to have to do a lot of that in life. Part of what took me into depression was living at elevation and then falling and finding I had a long way to fall, and it really hurt to hit the ground. So that was a huge learning for me. And the Florida Scott Maxwell quote about embracing everything that you are and have done, rather than having this image of ourselves, which is a sort of carefully curated image, Of all of my strengths and all of my successes and all of the ways in which I engage in self-justification, as contrasted with an honest look at who I am and the deals I make to get along, some of which compromise my own identity and integrity. To get honest about all of that is to find yourself on solid ground. I think the most solid ground that one can find in life.
Were there any parts of you that were particularly difficult to integrate? And if nothing comes to mind, don't worry about it. We can move on to the next question.
Oh yeah, there were lots. I mean, the depression was such a profound experience for me, because given the work I had done up to that point, the books I had written, the talks I'd given, I established a nonprofit called the Center for Courage and Renewal, which is still up and running 25 years later. I'd done all this work in the world, and when you do stuff in the world, you get projections from people. They imagine you, your readers, the folks who interact not with you, but with your ideas or your projects, they imagine you to be a certain kind of person. And the person that they imagined me to be would not be a person who fell into profound depression and even considered taking his own life, right? That doesn't fit with people who write about the spiritual life. We're supposed to be happy and on top of it all and just making the flowers grow every day. But that's not how life is. And so what I had to come to be able to do, and it took me time to do this, is to be able to stand up in front of people, either as an author or a speaker or a retreat leader, and without breathing up all the oxygen in the room, just be able to deliver a quiet message. I am all of the above. I am the guy who wrote the book that you love, and I am the guy who spent hours with his bedroom door shut, the shades pulled down, not able to get out of bed until 11 a.m., considering taking his own life day in and day out for a period of months. I am all of that and everything in between. And I got to the point where that was not difficult to do, because I had integrated all of it within myself, and I had come to understand how all of it has a place, all of it has a role to play in the way I live my life and in the way I do my work. And truth be told, I have evidence that going public about that, about the range of who I really am, didn't alienate my audience, but expanded my audience and got me more deeply connected with a lot of people. As you know, Niall, from reading Let Your Life Speak, I have a chapter there about my experience with depression called All the Way Down. And that chapter is not very long. It's maybe 15 pages. And it's in the middle of a book, and there are 9 other books out there. I probably have heard more about that chapter on depression than about any other single piece of writing that I've done. My book, The Courage to Teach, has launched some very big projects. So has my book, A Hidden Wholeness. It's not that these books haven't gotten traction. A more recent one, On the Brink of Everything, about aging, has also gotten traction. But that little piece about depression in Let Your Life Speak has brought in more email, more phone calls, led to more conversations of a really rich, engaging human sort than any other. So, you know, Leonard Cohen is famous for a line in one of his songs about there's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in. Well, I think when we follow Florida Scott Maxwell's advice and get fierce with reality about our own lives, that we are all of the above, then I think the light gets in and people connect around that light.
It's on my to-do list to buy your book for someone. And the reason I'm buying it for them is specifically for that chapter, because they've just been through a really dark depression later in life. And that's the reason I'm buying it from. So there's so much power in actually just being open about these things, you know? And just a comment as well. It seems that trying to live and maintain a projection that doesn't actually reflect your internal world, it must be absolutely exhausting. And it seems like the process of getting fierce with reality and getting on the ground with things is like, it's messy and it's difficult, but that's the only way to sort of let go of the mask, you know, and that must be very freeing once you've done it.
I totally agree. That's my experience. Thomas Merton once wrote a line that he's one of my literary heroes. Thomas Merton is spiritual heroes. He wrote a line, he said, most people live lives of self-impersonation, which I think is just brilliant. You know, we have this notion of who we want to be, and we self-impersonate, and it is exhausting. It's like wearing, you know, it's like getting up every day and having to put on a mask and a costume and memorize our lines to be who we think we ought or want to be. And it is greatly relieving to just be in the world as yourself. And there's one other piece that I'll add on that, again, that has to do with me being 85. So at 85, you think about your mortality a lot more than you do at 75, 65, 35. And I can't, at my age, I can't imagine a sadder way to die than thinking as I took my last breath, I never showed up in this world as myself. I never showed up with my true gifts. I never showed up with my true limitations. I never squared with myself or others who I really am. What in heaven's name was I doing for the last 80 plus years? That would be a very, very sad way, I think, to check out. And while all of us lead imperfect lives, you know, wholeness is not about perfection. Wholeness is about embracing your brokenness as well as what seems unbroken in you. That's what it means to be whole. It's not about being perfect. It's about putting your whole self into the human equation and growing as a result.
Sure. In a conversation with our mutual friend, Eric Zimmer, on the One You Feed podcast, I heard you mention something. I also, while we're talking about wholeness and sharing and vulnerability, you mentioned a quote from Carl Jung, which I thought is also important to bring up here. I want to get your comments on it. It was just that the soul needs its secrets as well. And can you maybe just give us a comment on that there and what your thoughts are in that regard?
Yeah, I deeply believe, I love a lot of Jungian thought. It was very helpful to me in my depression. And I deeply believe in this notion that the soul needs its secrets. So what I'm talking about when I talk about showing up with your brokenness as part of wholeness, because that's how the light gets in, there's a crack in everything. You know, I'm talking about I'm not talking about wearing your heart on your sleeve all the time, every moment of the day, about the latest painful or deadly experience you've had in life. So you just broke up with your dearest love. I'm not talking about wearing that heart, that part of your heart on your sleeve and going public with it. Not at all. There are things that we need to harbor within us in order so that they might come to maturation. Think of it as a pregnancy, if you like. Experience, human experiences that need to come to term before they can be birthed as something that contributes to our living. So I think a lot of us, you know, have had heartbreaks in our lives, but by holding them internally until they came to term, when we were able to see what role that heartbreak might have in the living of a fuller life, so the heart gets broken open rather than apart. You know, it gets stretched and enlarged rather than shattered. Then might be the time, months, years down the road, to include that as part of your more public discourse about who you are and what has shaped your life. And again, I don't mean you do this from center stage, but maybe an older person is talking with a younger person about the younger person's heartbreak and has a word of insight to offer about how the younger person might hold that heartbreak in a way that allows for growth going forward. It took me 10 years from the time of my first depression to the time where I felt comfortable talking about it in lectures or in retreats or writing about it in a book. And I'm glad that I somehow had the wisdom to wait it out over that decade, because it took me that long to realize, oh, this is part of who I am. And if I'm comfortable with that in myself, if I can say that to other people in a way that doesn't, you know, take me to the edge of a breakdown where they feel like they have to take care of me, if I can say that to other people in a way that comes from personal integration, maybe it will be of service to someone. And ultimately, I think, you know, one way of healing our deepest wounds is to put them at the service of others, which loops back to a concept that's always been important to me of the wounded healer, which is a kind of motif that Jung messes with as well, an archetypal motif of, you know, out of that wound comes healing for others. And for me, one of the ways you make meaning out of the hardest experiences of life is to offer them up for other people's healing, but not until they have become healed in yourself.
I think this is such an important point, and the metaphor I've heard this put elsewhere is that you should share scars, but not scabs, in the sense that if a wound is still open and raw, you know, that's not maybe the time to be sharing it. Whenever it's fully healed and it's a scar, maybe 10 years down the line or 5 years or whatever it takes, then you can share it, you know?
Yeah, we should not put each other under the pressure of, you know, get it out right now, you know. Wear your heart on your sleeve right now.
Totally. Okay, just a few more to wrap up, Parker. What are your thoughts on navigating the balance between solitude and a life of community? Because you've been in both of those quite deeply.
I think for me, both of them are essential to life, Niall. And I hold them not as either ors, but as a paradox. The whole notion of paradox is very central to my living and my thinking and my spiritual journey. Paradox being a statement about two things that may seem to be opposite on the surface, but in fact are complementary to each other and needed. I'll sometimes liken it to breathing in and breathing out, this paradox that the body engages in every moment of our lives. And to take a paradox like solitude and community and to break it apart and to say, you know, I think I'm basically a really community kind of guy, or I think I'm basically a really solitary kind of guy, is kind of like saying, you know, I think I'm basically a breathing out kind of person, so I'll just do that from here on out. It, you break a paradox, it doesn't sustain life. And so solitude and community, I think, have this really powerful reciprocal relationship with each other. And they are together, held together, they are a very important part of discernment, including vocational discernment. There are some things that we need to sit in solitude with, to be sure, to kind of examine ourselves, explore our own souls, listen for the voice of the inner teacher, or whatever you want to call it, and then go into community to be with other people in a way that helps us sort and sift what we're hearing from within. Because not every voice within us is the voice of the inner teacher. We also have a voice of greed, a voice of fear, et cetera, et cetera. But to have both in one's life, and community, incidentally, doesn't have to be a big deal. I'm not talking about a membership group. It could be two or three, four people with whom you have these trusting relationships and who know how to hold each other in a way that supports this inner listening, a way that doesn't pretend that someone else in the group knows what you ought to do or I ought to do with the dilemma we're currently wrestling with, but people who know how to hear us into deeper speech, that in a way that allows us to hear ourselves more deeply. In the work of this nonprofit that I founded called the Center for Courage and Renewal, we do a lot with what we call Circle of Trust retreats. And we try to create this kind of space for people where they can listen more deeply to themselves. And one of the fundamental ground rules in our Circle of Trust retreats is that no matter what a person may say, no matter how problematic it is or how struggling it is, we are forbidden from attempting to fix, save, advise, or correct that person. We are forbidden from attempting to fix, save, advise, or correct that person. And of course, that takes away what we mainly like to do and know how to do when other people present us with critical issues in their own lives. The quick and easy thing is to say, is to hear what that person said and then say, oh, hey, that happened to me once, and here's what I did. Why don't you try this, and I'm sure it'll all work out. I kind of call that, you know, drive-by counseling. The purpose is to get me in and out of the room as quickly as possible, pretending that I've paid attention to that person's need, but in fact, I've blown right past it and brought the focus back to myself. So in our Circle of Trust retreats, we say, instead of any of that stuff, fixing, saving, advising, and correcting, we can ask the person who's spoken an honest, open question. So somebody talks about a hard experience, and an honest, open question might be, you said you felt angry about what happened. How did that anger feel, and how did it manifest itself, and where was it located in your body? You know, that's an honest, open question, because I don't know. There's no right answer to that question, but it gives the person who spoke about anger a chance to dig deeper into what he or she meant when they spoke about anger. So when I talk about community in relation to solitude, I'm not talking about a group of people who think they know what we ought to do. I'm talking about a group of people who know how to hold us in a way that allows us to listen more deeply to ourselves. And then it's back to solitude. I think, you know, in solitude, we get closer to our own identity and integrity. In community, we start negotiating with the larger world in terms of what it might be evoking in us, which saves us from narcissism or solipsism. But being in solitude saves us from being so dependent on others that we're not living our own life. When you detach solitude and community, you get aberrations of both. So solitude becomes a kind of loneliness in which I don't even know who I am, and community becomes the crowd where I'm just lost. I don't have any sense of identity or meaning or relationship.
Yeah, I think it's a cycle that's can be very tricky to navigate, but I think artfully navigating it leads to a very rich and fulfilling life, you know. So I wouldn't ask this question. I've never asked this question of a guest before, but I think you're the right person to ask. Given where you are currently at in life and the life that you've lived, where do you sit with the question of, you know, what is the purpose, do you feel, of human existence? Like, why are we here? What are we doing? What are we doing on this planet?
That's a marvelous question. And of course,
I'm asking it sincerely. I really am.
Yeah, I know. I know that you are. I can feel the intent of the question. I think life is an amazing gift, all of it. Not only the glories and the delights, you know, the falling in love and the devotions that we develop and the giving of ourselves to this or to that, but also the struggling times, the dark times. So if life is a gift, I think my reason for being here is to live that gift as fully as I know how and learn as much as I can along the way about a life, about myself, and about what it means to live the gift. It you know, a gift is such an interesting thing. I didn't ask for it. I didn't expect it. I didn't sign up for it. I just got it. And when a gift comes out of the blue like that, a gift as immense as life, I mean, the opportunity to see what I've seen of the wonders of nature and of human nature, to see the acts of generosity and kindness and heroism that I've seen, as well as all the banalities of evil, and to keep working on how I navigate that very complex force field, and equally so, how I navigate the, in some ways, even more complex force field inside of me. It's endlessly fascinating. And all of us have a vocation of one sort or another, or let me put it this way, all of us make an impact on the world in one way or another. And if we can make that impact in a way that shares the fruits of whatever it is we're learning about the world and ourselves, you know, then I think that's another layer of why we're here, to share the fruits, either as a wounded healer or as someone with a kind of experiential wisdom that comes from someplace other than woundedness. So it's not just writers and speakers and teachers who can do that. Friends can do it for one another. Partners can do it in a loving relationship. Parents and grandparents can do it for children. Every profession can do it for the folks with whom they work. People in every profession can do it for the folks with whom they work. And so what it takes me to, Niall, in an inadequate answer to this big and important question is, if life is a gift, as it seems clear to me that it is, the call is to just keep passing the gift along.
Okay. Well, that's a great note to end on, Parker. I want to say thank you so much for your time. When I hear the name Parker Palmer, if I had to condense it down to one word, it would just be wisdom. So I want to say thank you for sharing some of that with us today. And where can people find you online, or where would you recommend people to go after this conversation? Maybe if you were to recommend a book they could start with, what would that be?
Yeah, well, I think you could start with Let Your Life Speak, which is available with all the in all the normal places where books are purchased. If there are teachers out there, The Courage to Teach might be of interest. For the elders out there, On the Brink of Everything might be of interest. But I don't know, I guess Let Your Life Speak would be a good starting place for most people. As far as finding me online, you can Google the Center for Courage and Renewal and find the work of that nonprofit that I established 25 years ago, as well as a section about me and my work on their site. And I have a Facebook author page where I post pretty regularly. Has a lovely crowd following it that I interact with a lot of pleasure. So they might want to check that out as well. And you're going to let me know when this airs, and I'd be glad to promote your work and this program or this podcast as well.
I'd really appreciate that. Okay, well, thank you, Parker. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk soon.
You too, Niall. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear the full version, you can do so with the Weekend University Premium Membership. This gets you access to our master library of over 5 years of psychology conferences, including over 230 talks and interviews with the world's leading psychologists, professors, and authors, unlimited CPD certification, transcripts, quizzes, premium passes for our annual conference, online courses with Richard Schwartz and Deb Dana, and more. The cost is £97 for 1 year, which breaks down at around 27p per day. The best bit is you can try it out for 30 days completely risk-free, as all orders come with a 100% money-back guarantee. If you're interested, please go to twumembers.com for more information.